Hello and welcome back to the Cory Doctorow podcast, and welcome back to me. I am back home after a couple of weeks on the road. I was in Minneapolis and then in Charleston, West Virginia. I got to meet several of you. Hi, nice to have met you. And now I get to go home and catch up on things. I paid my property tax, I filed some DMV paperwork, I took my dry cleaning, I just generally took care of business, and here I am taking care of some more business, recording a podcast. This is the last day, as I record this on Sunday, probably you won't hear it until later. This is the last day for the Kickstarter for the Lost Cause. It went superbly. Thank you to everyone who backed it. And soon I will be going out on the road for the Lost Cause, and I should probably have that tour scheduled for you next Sunday. But in the meantime, I have a couple of online events coming up this week. On October the 25th, I'm going to be speaking for the Edinburgh Futures Institute for a talk called Seizing the Means of Computation. And then on Halloween, which technically is next week, I guess, October the 31st, I'll be doing a virtual event with the Internet Archive. Both of those are free. I hope you'll join us online. They're at different times of the day for different conveniences of different audiences. So you got some choices there. I had a good trip being out on the road there. I am very excited about having got a chance to read Kelly Link's next book. It's her first novel. Kelly, if you don't know, is one of science fiction's great short story writers. She's won a MacArthur Prize for her short stories. And for 10 years, Kelly's friends have known that she's been working on this big, fat novel, the opposite of a short story. It's called The Book of Love, 600 pages long. I finished it on the plane home yesterday. It is so good. I'm going to be writing a review and a blurb for it today, just as soon as I finish talking to you. So yeah, keep your eyes peeled for that. If you like amazing, deceptively daffy and whimsical fiction that has like jagged razor blades inside of it, and that is full of this like contradictory warm feeling you get for characters you fall deeply in love with, and terror and rage at a set of increasingly dire circumstances. Boy, oh boy, is that a good book. Book of Love by Kelly Link. I think it's out in February 2024. It's just a little plug for you. Also forthcoming, I believe on Halloween, maybe a couple of days later, Tor.com is going to publish my novella, The Canadian Miracle. This is actually a kind of a prequel to The Lost Cause, and I'm going to be podcasting it here. I'm going to serialize it here. So I think starting next week, I'm going to be able to start serializing this for you. If you don't want to wait for the whole serial, you can always just go and read the whole thing when it gets published on Tor.com. But this week, I'm going to be reading you something different. I'm going to be reading you, as I often do, but as I won't be doing for much longer, one of my Medium columns. I mentioned a couple of podcasts ago that Medium has once again pivoted. They've done a lot of pivoting in their history, and they're not paying columnists anymore. And so I have mirrored all of those columns I wrote for Medium. There's over 120 of them that were exclusive to Medium. They are now at pluralistic.net/category/medium. I'm still going to be posting stuff to Medium, but it won't be behind their paywall anymore. It'll just be yet another channel that my pluralistic essays go out on. And yeah, I get my Sundays back. I'm not going to be writing a column every Sunday from now on, and I won't have to bank them up if I go away for Christmas or my birthday. And so yeah, I'm going to get a little more time to myself, which is quite nice. And I am going to go through and read some more of these into the podcast starting today. This one is called Micro-Incentives and Enshittification. Micro-Incentives and Enshittification. How the Curse of Bigness Wrecked Google Search. It's hard to convey just how revolutionary Google Search was when it debuted in 1998. It blew rivals from Ask Jeeves and AltaVista to Yahoo out of the water. It was so good, it was almost spooky, surfacing the best of the web with just a few clicks. Today, Google owns the search market, controlling more than 90% of searches. Its worth hovers in the $1 trillion range, and it employs some 180,000 people in offices all over the world. Almost every online journey we take starts with a Google search. And here's the thing. Google search sucks. It sucks in so many ways. Search results are cluttered with poorly denoted ads from businesses whose websites aren't good enough to warrant inclusion at the top of the listings on their own merits. The websites that do float organically to the top of the listings are often spammy garbage, filled with algorithm-pleasing nonsense. Woe betide the internet user looking for a simple omelet recipe. The top-ranked specimens have all been prepended with thousands of words of SEO verbiage about the first time I ate an egg. With the advent of large language models, Google results have gotten even worse as chatbots churn out nonsense on a superhuman scale. Incredibly, Google's response to this is its own chatbot, which will summarize the garbage novellas generated by SEO creeps into florid paragraphs laden with hallucinated lies, presented with the consciousness of a narcissist. Search and spam have always been at war. In the Alta Vista days, search engine optimization consisted of ending every page with seven paragraphs of white-on-white keywords, or keyword stuffing. Today, the SEO industry uses much more sophisticated techniques, locking horns with Google. Of course, Google's the first and often the last place we go to for answers, so snagging top billing in a Google search results page is, approximately speaking, equivalent to being true. Google is losing. Search for your local restaurant, a verified Google merchant no less, and the top result will be a scammer that cloned their website, jacked up their prices by 15%, who'll take your order, cream off that sweet 15, and then pretend to be you, and place the order with the restaurant. Getting rooked for 15% on your takeout meal is one thing, but that's strictly small time. The big money is in switching out the phone numbers Google gives for every major U.S. airline, substituting numbers for boiler rooms where scammers will take your credit card and rip you off for all you're worth. How did Google get this in shitified? And more to the point, why do we keep using it? Let's start with how hard it is to not use Google. Google spends $50 billion per year on deals to be the default search engine for Apple, Samsung, Firefox, and elsewhere. Google spends a whole ass Twitter every single year just to make sure you never accidentally try another search engine. Small wonder there are so few search alternatives, and small wonder that the most promising ones are suffocated for lack of market oxygen. Google search is as big as it could possibly be. The sub 10% of the search market that Google doesn't own isn't going to voluntarily come into the Google fold. Those brave iconoclasts are intimately familiar with Google search and have had to override one or more defaults in order to get shut of it. They aren't customers in waiting who just need a little more persuading. That means that Google search can't grow by adding new customers. It can only grow by squeezing its existing customers harder. For Google Search to increase its profits, it must shift value from web publishers, advertisers, and/or users to itself. The only way for Google Search to grow is to make itself worse. That is textbook inshittification. Here is how platforms die. First, they are good to their users. Then they abuse their users to make things better for their business customers. Finally, they abuse those business customers to claw back all the value for themselves. Then they die. And yet, Google must grow. Its founders and top executives hold portfolios stuffed full of Google shares, and when those shares fall, those key decision makers get immediately, personally, vastly poorer. Wall Street chases growth. If Google can't post growth, the big institutions that hold its shares will sell and the price will plummet, and Google's most important decision makers will lose vast fortunes. This is why Google's product managers are each charged with finding ways to increase the profitability of their little corner of the Googleverse. That increased profitability can only come from inshittification. Every product manager on Google Search spends their workdays figuring out how to remove a Jenga block. Worse more, these princelings compete with one another. Their individual progression through the upper echelons of Google's aristocracy depends as much on others' failing as it does on their success. The org charts only has so many VP, SVP, and EVP boxes on it, and each layer is much smaller than the previous one. If you're a VP, every one of your colleagues who makes it to SVP takes a spot that you can no longer get. Those spots are wildly lucrative. Each tier of the hierarchy is worth an order of magnitude more than the tier beneath it. The stakes are so high that they are barely comprehensible. That means that every one of these Jenga block pulling execs is playing blind. They don't and can't coordinate on the ways they're planning to lower quality in order to improve profits. The exec who decided to save money by reducing the stringency of phone number checking for business accounts didn't announce this in a company-wide memo. When you're eating your seed corn, it's imperative that you do so behind closed doors and tell no one what you've done. Like any sleight of hand artist, you want the audience to see the outcome of the trick, the cost savings, and not how it's done, exposing every searcher in the world to fraud risk to save a buck. This backstabbing, Machiavelli as a service corporate environment is what the trustbuster Louis Brandeis called the curse of bigness. Google commands billions in reserves that it can use to buy its way to dominance and out of competition, but the very scale that produced those billions ensures that the search we all rely on gets steadily worse, exposing us to grave risks as it spirals into enshittification. Google can't even grow its way out of this trap by doing new things. Any exec who successfully commands a new line of business has the potential to realize individual gains that dwarf those of even the most exalted EVP or even president. That's partly why Google has to buy other companies to get stuff done. Internally, every powerful person at Google is committed to ensuring that their rival peers don't stake out fresh territory as their own. The one thing that every top exec can agree on is that the one guy who's trying to expand the company into an adjacent line of business must not succeed. This is why every major push into a new line, social media, AI, requires a heroic push from the very top management, with the founders parachuting in to announce that they will lead the charge. To do anything less is to fail even before you start, and even then, success is far from guaranteed. The curse of bigness is by no means limited to Google. The other tech giants have each attained gigantic market shares in their respective territories. Even where there is a duopoly, say the Google-Apple mobile duopoly or the Google-Meta ad duopoly, growth is more likely to come through enshittification than competition. Google and Meta don't want to compete on their respective share of the ad market because each one is strong enough to seriously challenge the other. Instead, they illegally colluded to rig the ad market in order to steal from advertisers and publishers, who are comparatively soft targets. Likewise, Google-Apple's mobile duopoly is more cozy than competitive. Google pays Apple $15 to $20 billion every single year to be the default search in Safari and iOS. If Google and Apple were competing over mobile, you'd expect that one of them would drop the sky-high 30% rake they charge on in-app payments, but that would mess up their mutual good thing. Instead, these competitors charge exactly the same price for a service with minimal operating costs. But it's not just tech that faces the curse of bigness. Your bank, your insurer, your beer company, the companies that make your eyeglasses and your athletic shoes, they've all run out of lands to conquer, but instead of weeping, they're taking it out on you, with worse products that cost more. Enshittification follows monopoly, as sure as night follows day. All right, well, thanks for tuning in again. Next week, I will be back and I hope I'll be back with the first part of the serial of The Canadian Miracle, the prequel to The Lost Cause, my next novel, which is out on February the 14th in the US and Canada from Tor, which is a division of Macmillan, and in UK and the rest of the Commonwealth from Head of Zeus, which is a division of Bloomsbury. Talk to you next week.
You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, this song is copyrighted in the US under Seal of Copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ourn, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, W-R-Y-N-E-C-K Studio, @gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.